What is happening, everybody? Welcome to another episode of The Craft. My name is Nick Pollock here at Pitcher List, and joining me today is not Eno Saris. I know the normal guest. It's not Lance Brzozowski. We have someone truly special today. Those guys are special too, but it's, oh man, this is a five-time World Series champion, a five-time All-Star, 1994 Cy Young winner, YES Network broadcaster, ESPN Network broadcaster, and just like me, was unable to play baseball for a time after getting bit by a dog. It is David Cohn. David, thank you so much for coming on The Craft here.
My pleasure, Nick. Big fan of you for a lot of years. I think you know that. And, of course, Enos and Lance, too, as well. It's a great podcast.
Those guys are great. And, yeah. I mean, of course, the whole goal of this is just to talk about the craft of pitching. How do we put this ball into that imaginary box and don't let them hit home runs, right? And who better to do that than you with your resume, of course, and you know, just trying to fend off dogs all those future years. But I wanted to really take this opportunity to talk about how the game has changed, right? We are so overwhelmed by all the changes of baseball from the conditioning side to the philosophies and, of course, pitch types and the metrics that we have. And really showcase what was there back in the 80s, the 90s, even the 2000s, and to say, look, there are things we might be able to glean from those eras that we could even apply now that are maybe getting lost in the massive array of options that we have to look at, right? All the extra information. So I would say right now, the first question I really have for you is, what are the metrics that you're seeing now that you're just going, oh man, if I had that, that would be incredible?
Yeah, you know, there's so many subsets within the world of analytics, right? We tend to sort of lump everything under one umbrella, and there's so many differences and nuances between every different little subset, whether we're talking about, you know, the Edgetronic high-speed cameras as opposed to the Rapsodo machine, which gives you the spin rates, and two completely different things, different things. I am fascinated with the identification that we have now. And I think, you know, certainly the Edgetronic cameras, the high-speed cameras help a lot with it. I would have been all over it had I had the opportunity to work with that technology. But certainly understanding who you are as a pitcher, are you simply a pronator or a supinator? You know, and a lot of times you'd be surprised that some of the highest level professional pitchers really didn't have a clue of what they naturally do. And because of the high-speed cameras, we can identify what you are. Oh, you're a pronator or you're a supinator. And prime example of that would probably be Gerrit Cole, when he thought he was a pronator and he tried to throw two seamers all the time with Pittsburgh. And when he got to Houston, he said, oh, you know, you're not really a pronator. You're more of a supinator and you're more prone to four seam fastballs up in the zone with your power. And that's something as simple as that, being able to identify that the nature of what you do naturally is so impressive to me. And I just love that right there, boilerplate 101. What are you? Let's identify what you do well.
Right.
And then we can pitch design around that.
Absolutely. And actually, that's kind of what the Yankees do, right? I mean, I think of the Yankees having two types of pitchers. You have the Clayton Beater type, which is more of the old Luis Gil and Luis Severino, a power fastball slider going more over the top of that arm angle. And then you have the Clark Schmidt, the Michael King, the Will Warren, which is your lower arm slot, sinker focus, but then you are focused on that sweeper, that changeup as well. And it is really easy to just kind of bucket guys into two things. Okay, cool. Are you more of a four-seamer approach guy, or are you a two-seamer approach guy? Sometimes we get mixes, though, right? We get like Nick Pivetta is a perfect example for me where he's someone who's very over-the-top four-seamer, but then he throws this sweeper that requires a different arm angle. And, you know, looking at the data with this, you see that the four-seamer gets hit a lot harder than against right-handers and left-handers because he has a curveball that pairs with left-handers and then the sweeper for righties. You can actually see that difference, right? And did you ever – I know you changed arm angles all the time, right? This was one of the fun things about you. Did you ever think about that kind of effect a lot, and how did you manage it?
Yeah, it's a great question. You're right, because it's sort of the element of surprise.
Yeah,
needs to be retained a little bit. The more you use it, the less effective it becomes. So for me, in my personal experience, it was usually against a right-handed batter, usually against a big swing and miss type, whether that was let's say, Jose Canseco or Mark McGwire or mm-hmm. Cecil Fielder, that type of right-handed batter that I faced in the 80s and 90s, yeah, it would be the element of surprise. It would be more to shape the pitch, to sweep the pitch, to sweep the slider. And right. then I would throw a two-seam fastball off of that, either into the righties to set it up or away to try to backdoor sort of a two-seamer just mm-hmm. off of that changed arm angle. So I'd have yeah. a 1-2 punch. I'd at least have a fastball so that when I did drop down and change arm angles and they saw it coming, that there was still a little bit of mystery in their minds as to he might throw that fastball off of that as well. So that was me. It was a 1-2 punch. It was against right-handed batters, usually in a swing and miss situation, usually against a certain type of hitter that would chase. And then mm-hmm. I would just try to sweep it. I was throwing the sweeper. We didn't call it sweepers, obviously, back then.
Yeah, right.
I'm not against calling it sweepers now. I think it's admirable to try to put pitches in buckets so that we can compare and say who has
oh, yeah.
that, you know, to identify what kind of break it is rather than just, oh, that's a slider. Well, does it break vertically? Does it break horizontally? What kind of slider is it? So, you know, I applaud, you know, the classifications that we do now.
Absolutely. And you had a lower arm angle than say like Mike Mussina, right? And that obviously leaned into that more sweepy slider. You didn't have, I don't think, more of a gyro one, right? You had everything more horizontal. Is that right?
More horizontal. I definitely had a two-seam orientation with my slider. Yeah. You know, but when I first learned how to pitch, I was right on top of the seams with a two-seam fastball.
Mm-hmm.
I would come inside the seams on both seams and use both fingertip pads to throw sliders right. on the yeah. inside. So both fingers would be on the inside of the seams to be able to generate spin. Yes, like that. And then I'd kind of pinch them together a little bit, the fingers, once I got to the release point. But mm-hmm. for the most part, I was using my index finger, at least I thought, to generate spin as well as my middle finger.
Right.
And that was the first, you know, that's why when I first heard about seam shifted wake, I had a long call, and I've had a couple of calls with Dr. Barton Smith out of Utah yeah. State, whose whole crew coined the term seam shifted wake was through some of the testing they did with the cannon that they have that fires baseballs out at Utah State. You know, fantastic guy, really learned a lot from him. But that was my sort of my Rosetta Stone moment in my mind, trying to identify my own pitching, my own how I threw the baseball, trying to figure it out, how to teach it, how to pass it on. That was it for me. It was like, that's the kind of slider I threw. The seam orientation is what gave me the break that I got.
Yeah.
That was so unusual. And whenever I showed my grip to other pitchers, a two-seam slider, they laughed at me. You know, back in the 80s and 90s, you can't throw your slider like that. That's nuts.
Right.
Very few pitchers did. Nowadays, it's in vogue, obviously. I mean, a two-seam oriented slider is now the sweeper. Everybody's doing it. Everybody's trying it. There's different variations of the grip. But nonetheless, that's the slider I threw. I'm like the guy pointing, you know, at Spider-Man. It's like, hey, I'm doing this.
You're like Leo watching TV, right?
Yeah. I'm the meme. I'm a meme of myself now. The seam shifted wake. Hey, say over here, seam shifted wake guy. So
absolutely.
So that was it. That was my moment.
What's so funny? I remember actually I was invited to his presentation, Barton Smith's, when he initially revealed it. You know, and just here's our data, guys. This is it. Let me show it. And it was fascinating. I remember watching, being like, "Oh yeah, duh." And you want to know the funniest thing, Cone? I in college, I actually, when it comes to my education of pitching, it's very raw, in the sense that I learned very little things here and there, but most of it I figured out on my own. And I hate to admit this, my senior year of college, really going into that, is when I discovered, I kid you not, that I had to twist my back foot off the rubber. No one told me this. I had no whatever that, oh, this is how I'm supposed to open my hips. I really thought the entire time I'm supposed to drive off like I'm off a pool, but just the side of it, instead of actually flipping it open and pushing up. And it drove me insane that I had to find out on my own. And another thing of this is actually a two-seamer. I threw two-seamers. That was my thing. And I was doing seam shifted wake. I didn't know I was. I had no idea how this was working. I had no concept of the idea of seam shifted wake. I just knew that you threw them down the railroad tracks, as Lewis Thorpe would call them, right? But I thought what I was supposed to do was to make a reverse cutter. I thought I was supposed to do a shooto. So the whole idea of this is that you're pushing off and you're going against, you're essentially ultra pronating off of it and having your index finger the opposite of your slider inside of that theme seam to the middle of it, and then pushing with my index finger to the left. And I mean, it worked. Like I would do like the backdoor two seamer called strike three all the time. That's how I got all my strikeouts. But it wasn't until later I was like, oh my gosh, are you serious? I'm kind of almost doing the thing against what I want to be doing. Mm-hmm. And it blew my mind. And I just want to go back and talk to that kid and be like, hey man, here's just a couple things.
Yes.
It'll be a lot better. Trust me.
Yes. We all have that dream. Well, if I could just go back and talk to that guy at that point in time. Yes.
Oh my gosh. But I mean, actually I wanted to ask you this specifically. You've obviously, you learned a ton while pitching. You've also learned a ton now as well. I mean, what is the thing that you would actually say to yourself starting off now? And also, what would you say to someone who is younger right now developing at say like 12, 13 years old?
I would go back. The first thing I would do, and this may sound funny, but for me, I had a problem tipping my pitches my entire career, really, especially early in my career. And most of the time it was from the windup, very discernible from the windup. I had a teammate, Tommy Herr, who played for the St. Louis Cardinals back in the 80s and 90s, second baseman, came over to the Mets in the early 90s and became our second baseman and finally told me, said, hey, I got to tell you, this is what you're doing. We had all your pitches. You're tipping your pitches from the windup. So if I would go back, I would pitch from the stretch. I would just it from the stretch. There's less that can go wrong. You can hide the ball better. You can be more consistent that way. I never really gained that much from the windup. There's a lot of extra added movement that actually probably mechanically threw me off. Mm-hmm. You know, the more extra movement made me fly open more, was less concise, less on plane or online, so to speak. So that would be the number one thing I would do. I'd go back to that young kid that was 19 years old in A-ball, my first year of professional baseball. I'd say, just pitch from the stretch.
Yeah, There's a joy pitching from the windup, though, right? It like you move your body around. You feel so athletic. You feel great about it. And there's something to be said about gaining extra momentum from it. And you feel a little bit smoother. But I actually did that. I changed, I think, in high school to just pitching from the stretch, pitching from a simple leg lift and go. And it absolutely helped me be more consistent. And I say that often. It's one of the criticisms that I have a lot of pitchers and prospects coming up is that you see this windup that is just, it's too violent. It's too much is going on and you have to simplify it and you can identify the problems quicker, which is something I definitely want to talk about later with you, but we'll get there soon. And what would be the advice that you would give to someone starting off right now?
You know, for me, I guess it would be, certainly take advantage of everything you can in terms of training and medical data nowadays. There's a lot of changes in terms of, how you train for the game. Now, I'm not saying don't chase velocity. I would be throwing weighted balls. If I was 18 years old right now, I'd be out there doing everything. Plyo balls, weighted balls.
Oh, yeah.
I'd be doing anything I can to throw the ball 100 miles an hour. Absolutely, I would. But I would also say there's a balance there. And what the game is void of now, especially in starting pitching, is starting pitchers who know how to get easy outs, who know how to identify points in the game where you can just put the ball on the ground and get an easy out early in the count. You don't have to go maximum effort and go for swing and miss every single pitch. You don't have to do that, you know? And so, but I understand, the front offices and a lot of the pitching designs are centered around swing and miss. You know, you go as hard as you can, as long as you can, we'll get somebody else in behind you to do the same thing. But what we're talking about is the need for innings eaters, for people to put the ball in play. It's more entertaining, by the way, for the fans. We are in the entertainment business. We're not in the uber efficient, every pitch you throw has to be swung and missed, so there's no ball put in play. And that's the best way to have success. Well, but we're in the entertainment business. And if you're a starting pitcher and you want to pitch six innings and you want to throw 110 or 115 pitches, to get six or seven innings, you're going to have to get some two or three pitch outs.
Oh, yeah.
And have to trust your defense. You're going to have pitches designed to do that. And not every pitch has to be designed to be swung and missed at.
Man, I could have a very long conversation with you, I know, just about this, because I'm going to try and summarize it in about 15 seconds. I think the current landscape that says, hey, throw as hard as you can, because that's only how you get into college. That's how you get attention. That's how you get drafted. And that's how you make it to the bigs is terrible. And we have no incentives for pitchers to learn how to do the 90%, right? To understand that you should be throwing like Verlander and Carlos Rodon of, hey, I'm not showing my best early in the game. I'm showing it third time through the lineup. That's when I actually gear up my velocity as opposed to go down like Jared Jones does. And it's bad. It's terrible. This craft of actually being able to go nine innings is just not the ideal for teams right now, because we have so many other guys that can just do max effort. If you just do max effort across the entire game, shouldn't that be the best, you know, outcome? And there are a lot of things that need to change for that. And I don't believe in any way that we're going to see those changes, because you have more people than ever who can throw harder because we know how to train better for it. And that means you have such a massive pool of guys that it doesn't matter if this guy gets hurt. We'll just bring up another one. So do you have any solution that you've been thinking about this? I'm sure you've really given some thought to, like, how do we fix that?
Well, I think part of this, it's very nuanced, obviously, the answer. And there's no one answer that makes a lot of sense. But one of the issues I have in terms of the nuance argument is that when you think about the free market controlling itself, all these injuries, if you're going to chase velocity and you're going to take on more risk for injury, then you're going to become less valuable. And the guys who can – durability is a skill set. Durability is something that has more value every year as more of these injuries pile up. I think in some ways the market will self-correct. That the pitchers out there that can throw the ball in the low 90s, move it around, give you six innings of league average, whatever numbers – those are very valuable pitchers, especially as the injuries start to go off the chart and the Tommy John surgery start to add up. So I think naturally those guys will continue to gain more value as this market sort of self-corrects. And the other part is it's okay to teach pitchers how to anticipate the flow of the game and identify points in the game where you can get easy outs, where you don't have to go maximum effort, where you could throw a changeup right here. Or you can you can throw what we used to call a BP fastball, a little. You don't have to
still
throw
call it that.
You don't have to throw a spike powered kick change. You know, that's in vogue now. The kick change. It's kind of a power changeup. That's the new thing out there. All you have to do is learn how to just maybe take a little off your two seamer and throw it down and away. And you know, Netflix has a show. Coming out on the Red Sox from 2024 last year.
Yeah,
I don't know if you've seen.
Oh, I did. It's great.
With the conversation Tristan Casas has with himself when he grounds out to second base on a little doo-doo BP sinker down and away. That is so valuable for a pitcher. That mental warfare. I just got you out with a little nothing. Pitch, and that's going to mess with your head more than me throwing 100 miles an hour by you.
100%.
The mental warfare that I miss as a pitcher, like messing with guys. You know, that's the art of pitching. You know,
so
that's something that can be taught.
I love that you mentioned this because it's something we don't really see. We don't see these wide velocity bands anymore with fastballs. And when I was a senior, this is actually something that I learned was the layoff fastball is what we called it. So you know, you're in a count where they're going to jump out of their shoes. They feel like they have it timed, and then you throw something slower. And then all of a sudden I get my ground out at like a 2-0 count. And it takes a lot of guts to do that.
Yes.
To all of a sudden be like, okay, it's 2-0, but like, I'm going to throw something that's even softer, you know, and you don't realize it and all that kind of thing. And when I was at my peak of that, doing that, my fastballs would range from like 74 to 82 or something like that. Like I would actually use it. And I think the best game I ever pitched in my career was against, I think, the number 2 high school team in the country, which I didn't know it was. And I just went 5 innings in Florida and I got taken out, and then we lost the game, and I will never forgive my coach for that. But it was because I even heard their dugout saying, he's changing speeds and all that. But there was one moment, David, where I screwed up. Okay. It was, I don't know if I told you this story. We played against Grand Street. This was, you know, a big public school in New York City here. My high school, Berkeley Carroll, would have a exhibition game against them before our relative tournaments. And I was pitching in like 3 days or so, but instead of doing like a bullpen on the side, my coach said, you know what, it's the fourth inning. Just go in there, go like one inning there. We don't really have an extra catcher. Just do that. I'm like, fine. So I see this big lanky guy, super lanky. He's like the talk of New York City. His name is Dylan Patonsis. And, you know, we all know he's a pitcher, but here he is, like, he's up there 6'6". And it's a 2-0 count. And I'm like, well, got to throw my layoff fastball. Thing is, I'm not throwing 100%. I'm throwing like 70%. It's my bullpen. I'm not trying to max effort this or anything. So I throw this thing. It's probably like 65. And I throw like right down the middle. My good friend Brett is catching that day. He never really catches. I throw this right down the middle. Like left, center, bam, just gone. Like well over, like the farthest hit ball I've seen. My friend Brett takes off his mask, steps out in front of the home plate, goes, wow. and so Dylan goes around, you know, I'm like, yeah, all right, this feels pretty bad. But it's also Dylan Betances. And then I realized, David, I think this is the last home run he's ever hit because he got drafted and it was a state tournament. And I've never been able to ask him this. One day, Dylan, I'll find you.
Yes.
Like, Dylan, do you remember that stupid, scrawny white dude? That
we got to make this happen. I'm going to get a hold of Dell. We're going to make this happen. This has to happen now. We got to get these two on here.
Be careful with the layout fastballs, guys. All right?
It's true. There is risk reward. That's for sure.
But I think you're absolutely right, though, about this. Though that element of pitching is what's lost a bit. It's about, like, right now what I see is you do this, and you do this. And it's like, well, hold on. There's a whole spectrum of how you mold the things. You know, I used to see guys like Patrick Corbin and Jacob Junis have a really good slider. So they just threw it slower at times to get like a kind of a curve out of it, right? To try and really exploit that strength. And what I'm hearing is, hey, Jared Jones, you throw 99. Great. Don't throw 99 right away. Throw like 95 and then throw 98 and then pull it back. And you have to have the confidence to say, like, even at 95, I'll be okay, right? I mean, I think I'm hearing you right in this way of just, like, we need to see more of that variance throughout the game.
Absolutely. You know, and I think, you know, if you look at some of the success like Michael King, former Yankee, mm-hmm. the Padres has with his two-seam, four-seam combo, saving the four-seam as a put-away pitch for a swing and miss at the end of the at-bat, using the two-seamer to get ahead or early for contact, to keep the ball on the ground early in the at bat. So that combination of two seam, four seam, we're seeing actually the young pitcher with the Yankees, Will Warren, kind of do that this spring, kind of starting to hone in on two seam, four seam. And I had a talk with Aaron Judge about that, about pitchers who do that, who mm-hmm. actually feature both two seams and four seams prominently. And he said that was one of the toughest things for him to pick up, is like you gear in on a certain type of release point or spin, break, movement profile, and you gear up for that, and then you get the complete opposite on a four seam following that two seamer up. And he said that's a hard adjustment for hitters to make. So that's right into that same kind of category of, I'm not going as hard as I can. I'm using some finesse with the two seamer and then surprising you with the four seamer. In some ways it protects the four seamer, you know, a little bit, and saves it for when you do need that pop up or that swing and miss, or that, you know, sometimes the easy outs are pop ups on the four seamer up.
Absolutely. Once again, David Cohn is speaking my language. We're going to continue more with talking about this because I have so much to say about that specifically after this break. So the one thing that I've noticed, I mean, every year there's always like something I'm like, oh my gosh, why was I ignoring this before? And Garrett Crochet actually really illuminated it to me, a little bit of Kodai Senga too, of really fastballs in the zone that move differently. And that's really what we're talking about here, right? Sinkers versus four seamers. But with Garrett Crochet, it's like, hey, I'm a 7 feet plus extension guy, which I had no reference point before. We just have really cool data here at Pitcher List. And, oh, you do that at high velocity, and then you have a 93 mile per hour cutter that moves off of that. It's so stupid good. And it's why like Kodai Senga, who has kind of a hittable four-seamer, is able to get away with this cutter in the zone that looks like that four-seamer, but it's like 4 miles per hour slower. And guys just can't tell the difference of it. That to me seems like where the game is going right now. We've seen 5-6 pitch mixes happen. We're seeing more guys embrace the inside sinker to right-handers. This is how Zach Wheeler has become a stud, is just literally this for ages. We don't talk about his slider or his curveball or something. It's extension with those two at high velocity. Is that something that you mess with? And do you believe that really is just, you have to be doing that in the game now?
I did. It's a hard thing to master. You know, I did do it. There were times in the course of a game where I couldn't maintain the feel for both grips. You know, sometimes mm-hmm. you warm up in the bullpen before a game, you try to take your two seamer and your four seamer to the mound in that first inning, one of them's off. You're pushing, you're missing high arm side with your two seamer, your four seamer, you're yanking down and away. You can't find the happy medium. So sometimes you got to can one of them early in the game to establish strikes. You know, ideally you'd be, you know, when you're on and you're feeling it and you're able to feature both in one at bat to somebody like an Aaron Judge, that's when you're going well. But it's easier said than done. It's a hard skill to master. The release point, the feel, the fingertip pressure, the grip, different types of movements. What are you trying to do with it? Are you a pronator? Are you a supinator? I mean, there's so many variables involved now that back then it was just guesswork. In the 80s, I'm just guessing at this stuff. You know, I didn't really know. I thought I knew, but I didn't really know. You know, if I was, I was probably more of a pronator than a supinator because of the sweeper, you know, and me around the ball more. I guess visually, when we start using these terms, I like to back it off and go, okay, let's define who's the best pronator in history that you saw and who's the best supinator in terms of, a, you know, visualize in your mind a pitcher that you know very well. I'll start from the supinator side, Mariano Rivera, right? The cutter, more the around the ball kind of release point guy. You know, that's a supinator. Now, a pronator is the guy who wants to get inside the ball and come, you know, inside the ball this way.
Got to be Maddux.
Max is one. There's a guy that pitched for the Red Sox, Derek Lowe,
who has
the best sinkers I've ever seen. A true boom, you know, that get inside the baseball, you know, pronate, make the ball sink. You know, that was his natural way to throw the ball. He couldn't throw the ball straight. He couldn't really throw a four-seamer all that well. But Mariano Rivera couldn't really throw a two-seamer all that well until he learned, you know, maybe to tweak the grip with a one-line sinker. You know, everybody talks about the one-line sinker now. Mel Stottlemyre threw that back in the 60s, by the way. He taught me that one-line sinker. You know, he taught Mariano Rivera that one, too. That's Mariano was such, you know, a supinator that, or, you know, or a pronator, rather, that he couldn't throw a two-seamer that would sink. It would cut on him. It would run. It wasn't consistent at all. So I guess visually maybe that helps. If you're thinking about supinators versus pronators, Mariano Rivera on one end and then Derek Lowe on the other end is the guy who turned the ball over.
Absolutely. Oh, man. So it is also just really interesting that we have this better information now to, again, as you mentioned before, we know what you are, right? And you can really embrace that. Do you believe in, okay, cool, you're not supposed to be good at this, but it's still helpful for you to throw it? Like a good example, it would be actually, you know, as you're talking about, Zach Eflin saves his four-seamer. And by all the metrics we have, like this does not have vert. It doesn't have that rise that we want. It's not really necessarily hard. It's not a great attack angle, all of that. But because it's different and he saves it for two strike counts, he actually has a pretty good put away rate and gets whiffs on this pitch when he locates that upstairs. Would you suggest that for a lot of pitchers that say, hey, look, I know, Michael King, you're not necessarily the best one at this, but you should keep throwing that four seamer just because you can command it and you have those moments?
Absolutely. And saving it for the right time, that's another art of the craft, I think.
Yeah.
That's still prevalent out there, still a big part of pitching that maybe doesn't get talked about enough. You know, I'm happy to hear you talk about that issue, especially. But absolutely, just the conversations I have with hitters about what they're looking for, how tough is that to hit, what does that look like, what does Michael King's two-seamer look like to a right-hander when it's boring in on him, just running like crazy in on him, and then the four-seamer off of that with two strikes, what did that look like? Hitters tell the story. They tell you by how they react to it, how they swing at it, whether they're out in front of it, whether they take it. There's feedback on every pitch.
Absolutely.
Right? That's part of learning the game, too, is throwing the pitch and then getting instant feedback. The talk of spring this year has been the challenge system. Don't let pitchers do the challenge system because their heads are flying. They don't really have a good vision of the strike zone. You know what you have good vision of is the hitter's reaction.
Yeah.
Afterwards, and you should be keen on that. You know, that's the first thing I ever looked at. Where every pitch I threw, what did the hitter do there? Did he take it? Did he look like he was taking it the whole way? Is he swinging? Is he a first pitch fastball hitter? All those sorts of things come into play that are all part of the craft of pitching. Absolutely, learning when to throw what pitch, how to sequence your pitches, to me is everything. It really is, because you can, that along with conviction, you can, you know, if you have, you could have shitty metrics on any pitch you throw, but if you have awesome conviction and you set that pitch up well, it's going to work. There's a chance it's probably going to work, you know? So, you know, it's not one size fits all.
This is when I remind David that this is a family-friendly, G-rated podcast, but no, it's coming from a place of passion, of course.
Yes.
But, oh man, there's so many things I want to mention here. First, that, you know, talking about the four-seamer sinker differentiation too, guys like Ben Lively last year with the Guardians were like, this should not work, but looking into it, he has this amazing tunneling of his four-seamer and sinker, and he throws them confidently in the zone, and those work. Because they just don't know which one it is each time. And it means that guys have that little extra moment of hesitation when they're trying to hit at it. And that's how Ben Lively had that success. And we just saw yesterday with Brady Singer, actually it was 2 days ago in spring, all of a sudden throwing four seamers. And this is a complete, you know, what you're talking about. Like he is a sinker slider guy. He cannot do that over the top four seamer thing. And it's not a good metric four-seamer, but he threw more four-seamers and sinkers, got whiffs on it. It was a surprise, and it worked. And that can actually be a thing because now there are two fastballs that they have to deal with. They can't just think this is the sinker, sell it for the sinker, and then hit that. It's an interesting development, and I'm very curious to see how that moves forward. It might, you know, it's a pendulum of hitters, right? They expect one thing, everything became four-seamers at the top of the zone. Then all of a sudden, you got to move away from that maybe, and getting too used to the Jared Jones types and everything like that. So I'm really curious about that. And the second thing, I don't know if I shared this with you. I don't think I did. In 2000, I want to say it was 22, maybe 23. I was watching the World Series and I guess it was 23. I got really, really inspired to talk about exactly what you're saying, which is how to sequence. And actually what sequencing is not, I hear this conversation a lot. I'm very much I hate the conversation of this is a bad pitch because it has a slugging of this. And because of the down and away slider, whatever it is, mine has a high slugging. I don't want to throw that. And using result stats to say that this is why this pitch doesn't work or not, as opposed to generally what kind of pitch works in this one. What, you know, this guy has hit those, sure, but what were those? Were those good sliders? Were those good changeups there? Were they the right time to do it? Was there something that the pitcher was doing in his arsenal that suggests that this is what it would be? Though it doesn't quite encapsulate it. And you can throw anything at any point. Well, you can throw anything if it's at the right point and identifying when that is. And so I wrote this whole document on Notion called The Secrets of Sequencing, being like, okay, first, you gotta have like a level of command. You can't do this if you're just kind of like glove in the middle of the plate. Like, all right, should I throw a slider or a fastball now? It just doesn't work. You have to be able to confidently throw strikes and stuff. Two, you have to really have like three pitches or so. Like three. You can't just do like the 1-2. It doesn't really work that way. But with all of that, there are so many of these little things inside of at-bats and what they tell you. And I would love for you to share just some of those from your perspective of what you're looking for from a hitter during an at-bat to say, okay, I should do this instead of that.
Yeah, there's so many. You know, I think this is the nuanced part that I love. You know, we could spend all day talking about these sorts of issues. It's even more important. Everything you said is so spot on because it's even more important today. There's more information than ever before. If you walk into a major league clubhouse before the game, the hitters meetings, all the information they have, the videos, the constant roll of videos of the pitcher, that's the opposing pitcher that night. They see every pitch you've ever thrown them, not only personally, but to every hitter that's even close to them or similar to them. They've seen every pitch that you have. So they anticipate better than ever what's coming. We know what you have. We know what your pitches do. We know what you like to do. So it's even more important for pitchers to mix that up a little bit, you know, on the way. I think that's a lost art. A lot of times when you go into games, how do you game plan? Are we pitching continually to the weakness of the hitters? Yeah, I knew the weakness of the hitters, but I also wanted to pitch to my strengths as well. So back in the 1980s, I would get an advanced scouting report about an opposing lineup, and they'd say, watch out for Pedro Guerrero. He's hitting sliders lately. He's really a good breaking ball hitter. And I would immediately say, who's breaking ball? Whose slider?
Right.
Who did he hit that? That's not my slider.
Right.
It's not the same quality as the one I'm going to feature tonight. So, you know, it was buyer beware a little bit in terms of the old school scouting reports. Nowadays, there's nothing left, you know, mm-hmm. to hide. They know everything about you. So what you do and how you attack hitters and how you plan and how you sequence pitches is even more important. And when you give a different look, you watch. When hitters go back to the dugout, they're all talking to each other more than ever before. I mean, I didn't see Ricky Henderson talk to the next hitter on deck, Carney Lansford, after I struck him out. He'd walk right back to the dugout. They didn't share information the way they do now. Mm-hmm. They're not looking at iPads on the bench. You know, they didn't back then. Obviously, we didn't have iPads. Now, every at-bat, every pitch, they're dissecting every little movement you make. So diversity and mixing it up is even more important to your point of view. So,
definitely. So like inside of an at-bat, right, you throw something and you see a reaction of some kind. I mean, there's loads of these. A good example I know is, all right, how they're fouling a ball off, like where it goes, kind of showcases, are they late? Are they on it? Are they not? A good example is for me, fastball goes straight back is, oh my gosh, they're so close there. You got to be careful right now. You have to get their timing different, right? Yeah. Or if you're inside and they drag it down the line, they're super ahead of it. That kind of thing, obviously, right? But there are more nuanced ones. I mean, I remember Coach saying, like, we're battling college hitters. So we don't know them at all. We have to figure out some things quickly. So if a guy is super close to the plate, it means that he's really good at the inside corner, and he wants to turn the away into inside as much as possible because that's his weakness. So it might seem weird, but you actually want to throw him away. While a guy who's far away from the play is the opposite. He's good as away, so he's trying to turn inside into away. Little things like that. But what are some of those little tips that you would get during an at-bat that would change how you would sequence?
I try to find the bat path, you know, throughout a course of an at-bat. Let's say if I was facing Tino Martinez back when he was with the Mariners, circa 1995, in that lineup, Ken Griffey Jr. and Jay Buhner and that great Mariners lineup, Edgar Martinez, I'd want to find out what Tino's bat path was. In order to do that, I'd have to throw him sort of flat cutters up and in. Mm-hmm. I would try to get to a point, try to get ahead somehow, maybe a curveball ahead or a fastball down and away, some pitch to get ahead with. And then in the middle counts, middle count 1-1, 0-1, 2-1, I would try to throw flat cutters up and in to see what he would do with it. And I wanted to see if hitters would get around that, lefties would get around it and yank it foul. And that way I would learn his bat path and know, okay, now I could chase him on down and in off the plate and maybe he'll chase it. Or maybe I need to really be careful with off-speed pitches middle away because he's got that slightly around hook kind of a swing.
Right.
Ken Griffey
right.
Jr. had that kind of a swing too, is that he just murdered mediocre off-speed pitches middle away. Actually, he could take pitches outside and hook them and still hit home runs. It's kind of that Joe Carter hooking style swing. So that's what I wanted to find out. Identify the bat path of the hitter and therefore then know what I have in my repertoire to get him out when I get in a put away pitch type of account.
Oh, that's a great call. I mean, when you say a flat cutter, do you mean that you're actually making it flatter on purpose to get that information?
Yeah, I wanted it to stay up. I wanted it to look like a middle end fastball and I wanted it to chase him in and I wanted him to get around it and yank it foul. A lot of times I hope they hit just a screaming bullet over the dugout. Or way foul, you know, not one of those ones that he almost kept fair. But I want him to hammer it, but I want him to get around the ball, you know. And that way, I've identified, you know, what he wants to do. He wants to, you know, he's sort of a hooking style, you know, path of swinging. Whereas the opposite of that path, that bat path, would be Edgar Martinez. Mm-hmm. Who, if you tried to pitch him inside, he was good at bringing his hands in and keeping the ball fair, like cutting it off at the pass. You know, that's a whole different bat path. That's what I wanted to identify throughout an at-bat. What tendencies were there?
Right. No, that's amazing. And I think, at least from what I was noticing back in 2023, I think it's changed a lot. Just even the past year, because of the way that the Boston Red Sox stopped throwing fastballs, was generally when a batter comes up to the plate, they're expecting a heater. I mean, they're just sitting. The first thing that they do is they sit heater. And this general assumption, which is obviously an assumption and just very, you know, broad stroke of the brush, is that they look fastball until it's 0-2, then they look breaking ball, and then they feast on one. They look at it, they spit on it. Great, I've earned my fastball back. That is the most basic of like what hitters expect, Would you say that that's accurate? Is that something that you kind of thought with, or was it, or did you feel like everyone was a little different? Was that just the elites were different? Is that a safe assumption?
I must admit, I had to think about that one a little bit, right? I mean, when you dig into that a little bit, I'm sure, you know, it seems like it's almost counterintuitive, you know, because we were talking on the broadcast. We had data on the broadcast about how little fastball, you know, how few fastballs the Red Sox as a pitching staff was throwing every night. That would be a narrative.
Right.
You know, at some point that's going to work against you. And I do think the Red Sox adjusted and threw more fastballs the second half. I know there's ebbs and flows and you have to make adjustments along the way. Andrew Bailey's an outstanding mind, baseball mind, I think, pitching mind. I think they're well resourced and backing up all their theories with well resourced data. So, you know, I have no problems there, but I do still feel like no matter what you're doing and what you're doing well, once it becomes a trend, everybody knows it, everybody gets on it, you better make adjustments. Adjustments on the fly, adjustments inning to inning as a pitcher. One inning, your curveball's working, next inning, it's not. My four-seamer's jumping one inning, it's not there today. I have to do more two-seamers. You know, those sort of in-game adjustments that you have to make, factoring in, you know, what the scout reports on you are, you know, really, to me, is the cat-and-mouse game that I miss the most. You know, that guessing game.
Oh my gosh. I mean, when I was, I had my curveball. That was my thing. That was just like, you can't hit my curveball. And being able to say like, okay, cool, this is the curveball this time, but then it's not. Now I've got you in a, you know, 1-0 and behind, I just put a sinker in there and you just dribble it to the third. I'm like, this is the best feeling ever.
Yeah.
Like you're just, oh, this is easy. I can just take a break. I think I had a 3-inning save that was, I think, 22 pitches. And it was, I think, 21 or 20 strikes out of 22. I was just like, let's go home. That was so fun. But yeah, right. It's just like, what do you want from me? What are you actually jumping out of your shoes for? And I generally thought that the first pitch was always the hardest pitch. I imagine you feel so too, because I don't know what really you want yet. And I'm just like testing the waters for a second. Saying, okay, cool. If I put this in here, did you take it? Do you just always take a pitch? You always take a
yes.
pitch. I don't believe that. Thank you. That's free. Wonderful. Now you're behind. How would you, I imagine it would be like a first pitch curveball. We know that one.
Sure.
That's staple. Show me curveball. Right. But when you're like, okay, I'm in this tough situation and I need to, I'm a little scared of throwing that first pitch curveball. Like what was your attack plan? What was the, like, I see a righty right now. Maybe I'll get that quick out with a sinker. Maybe I'll attack him with a slider first. Like, what, you know, it always changes, but what is really your default state there?
There's a couple of different ways to go about it. I mean, a lot of theories. One of my big theories was, you know, you could get fearful on the mound. You can get sort of like, oh, this guy's a really good first pitch fastball hitter. I can't throw my fastball. Let me try a breaking ball, 1-0. Oh, now he's really looking fast. Let me throw another 2-0. You missed two in a row because you're defensive on the mound. Now, okay, this guy's a really good first pitch fastball hitter. Let me pitch bad to his strength. Meaning, okay, you know what? I'm going to give him what he wants, what he's looking for, only just a little in a little worse location than he likes it. So, oh, you're really good at fastballs inside? Well, hit this one and chase him inside hard. You know, give them what they want, but what we call pitching bad to their strengths. And to me, that was a good way to sort of face your fears head on with a really good hitter you had trouble with. You know, rather than trying to pitch so defensive, oh, no, I got to trick him. Oh, no, I can't give in. Oh, no, 3-0. Oh, here's a little changeup. No. You know what? What are you looking for? What do you like? I know what your strengths are. Okay, here it is. Let me pitch design the pitch he's looking for, but in a location that he's gonna exploit himself. He's going to get himself out.
You know, I love that. I mean, that really goes back a little bit to the layoff fastball that we've been talking about.
Yeah.
But yeah, really like extending the zone, right? We talk about that a lot. And when we had Pablo Lopez on, he really asked him this question and he made a really great point about, hey, the rule of thumb is man on second, you throw a breaking ball. The first time you get a man on second, you not throw a fastball, right?
Well, you don't want to get beat with a fastball,
right? Well, it's the point that Pablo was saying is like, yeah, they're going up there and they're not being afraid in those situations. They want to pass the baton. They feel like momentum's there. They're aggressive. They want to get that guy in, and that means they're fastball hunting and they just want to knock it in. And you just, if you throw a breaking ball, like you'll get a called strike. I call it free real estate. And it's unbelievable how good of a shot you have at a called strike on a breaking ball for the first time a man's on second, right? You see a big boy at the plate, just throw a breaking ball.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, RBI still matter to hitters.
You know? Oh yeah, of course.
In the metrics, we can talk about it being an opportunistic stat, maybe not really the true indicative metric to use to evaluate hitters, but it matters to hitters. Hitters love to have high RBI counts.
Oh yeah, Albert Pujols says that is his proudest stat.
Yeah,
was how many runs he scored for his team, which I totally get. You got to take advantage of it.
Absolutely. You got to have opportunities to drive in runs too. So,
absolutely. So we're going to talk a little bit more about how we develop that sequencing, and also just the little nuances of the game that aren't really necessarily inside of the metrics themselves. And we'll talk about all of that after this break. So I do want to get your take on in season and adjustments that players can make, right? I mean, what's easy now is you say, hey man, you lost 2 inches of vert, what's going on, you know, or hey, get more extension, all that kind of stuff. But for you, when you were making those adjustments in your bullpens, how did, you know, what was the checklist for you? And what are some of those little tweaks you made?
Yeah, I think it's age related. It's miles related, where you are in your career. Everything can change later. I know the older I got, the more recovery time I needed, how important mm-hmm. recovery time became. You know, when I was young, I was like, no, I could go 4-man rotation. No problem. You know, you talk a real bold game. I could pitch back in the 50s, you know, throw BP in between starts, you know, and pitch every fourth day, you know. So, but what I really found when I was objective with myself and after I had the miles on me was that, you know what, recovery is so important. You know, I was a big contrast bath type of guy. I was a sauna, cold plunge guy back in the 90s, back before it was in vogue. After every start, I was in the pool. I was in the sauna. I was in the pool. I was in the hot tub. I would cycle around about 3 or 4 times, and you know, out of each section, each station. So that was my thing. You know, it was pool work, sauna, and cold plunge. So, you know, taking care of yourself too is a big part of it. But rest and recovery is big. Yeah. That's why I'm an advocate, especially when the pitchers who are going maximum effort now. Training so hard, pushing the envelope for velocity, throwing upper 90s, yeah, extra rest matters, you know, and really, really helps.
This is the proposal I have is I truly believe that the rule change should be if you start a game, you cannot pitch until 5 more games later. So to essentially force in a 5-man rotation, or actually you can even do it to 6. Yeah. And that also means you can't have the opener. It also then incentivizes longevity as opposed to 4 innings or whatever, because then they can't go for another 5 games. That's my proposal, which I think just makes for a better game. I don't think fans really want bullpen games. I think they want to see pitchers go longer into games and to have this true pitcher's duel. It also would incentivize runs, honestly, because you're gonna have worse performance from pitchers. And I know, weird. I'm usually like, yo, let's make every pitcher amazing. This is great. But that makes it even more special to me when you have your Sandy Alcantaras dominating, your Zach Wheelers, Logan Webb, right? We should be romanticizing those players. And I don't think we're quite at that state right now. You know, me and Pitching Ninja doing all our gift stuff back in like 2015 and something like that. Really, like, that's what we love. We love the filthy pitch, the 100, the stupid, amazing slider. I remember when Noah Syndergaard threw a 95-mile-per-hour Worthen slider, which was just a harder, like a cutter, but more slider action on it.
Yeah.
And I was just like, what? Like, that should never happen. And then again, he wasn't able to go deep into games often. So I love leaning into that more. But rest and recovery is exactly it.
I think it is. That's a big part of it. You know, everything you're saying, you know, I'm sure something's probably going to be done. If I had to place a wager that there will be some sort of rules revision that's going to enhance starting pitching one way or another, either along the lines of what you're suggesting or something else that's creative, mm-hmm. that's going to incentivize staying with the starting pitcher longer during the game. Maybe we're biased because we grew up a certain way, you know, and love the game and love pitching.
The best part, David, we know it.
I get it. You know, we all have our own internal biases, you know, and let me preface with saying that I have my own. But with that being said, How are you going to get through the third time in the lineup? How about Ken Griffey Jr. facing me the third time and getting another crack at me? Maybe I got him out the first two times and he's pissed. And, you know, that sort of back and forth part is something the fans are used to, too, that they really got into. Hey, whoa, you know, he's got first and second in the seventh inning. Oh, how's he gonna get out of this one? And he has to, or the sixth inning or whatever. You know, you got to stay with him because the rules have changed. So the starting pitcher's got to do this.
Yeah.
That's interesting. You know, when you think about it, try to play that scenario out in your mind. We all know what the metrics say. We all know what the data says. Bring in that guy throwing 98 that you just called up from AAA that this guy hasn't seen before, you know, and let him chuck it in there and your probabilities go up for success. I get it. We understand that. We understand the predictive nature of all these guesses and what the metrics give you, the information to make these bets. We got it. I understand. I'm with you. I love it too. I love all the information. But with that being said, we're in the entertainment business. And what's entertaining? And how do we identify, you know, what's really entertaining and how we feature that part of the game more prominently? If that's starting pitching, then so be it. Bring in all the suggestions for, you know, how do we make starting pitching more prominent again?
And, you know, this is one I thought of earlier in this podcast even, which everyone's going to hate. So I apologize in advance. What if we limit how many people can be on the IL and be more strict about it? Because if what we're saying is, cool, it's fine if you get hurt, I'll have another guy and I can just kind of keep going to that well. If it's a major issue if they're hurt, I mean, yes, of course, like then it incentivizes players to not say that they're hurt. And we don't want that either. But there might be, I don't know, there might be something too. Maybe don't make it a 10-day IL, make it a 30-day guarantee or something like along those lines, right?
Interesting thoughts. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it could be a combination of a lot of these issues. The shuttle up and down, knowing that, hey, I'm a AAA reliever. I have options, so that makes me more valuable because, you know, they can blow me out or we have a blowout game and we'll just, you're out and somebody else is in and see guys up and down all year long on that AAA shuttle. You know, that's not so entertaining either, you know, and that's not conducive to good workplace environment. And that really, you know, in terms of you'd like baseball to be a meritocracy, right? I already paid my dues in college, minor leagues. I'm in the big leagues. I'm doing my job and you're sending me out because of a loophole in the option rules or because I can, you know, they have the shuttle that's used, maybe close that gap a little bit.
Right.
You know, disallow that up and down shuttling so that you do keep the starting pitcher in longer or, you know, however that resonates.
Yeah. And we're also seeing, I mean, I'm seeing it right now with spring training. We have these NRIs who essentially, if they make the team, they stick around. And like a team like the Yankees, like you might see Carlos Carrasco as SP5 because they have that. And if it's Will Warren, then they don't have Carlos Carrasco later when there's not any
exactly. You have to protect depth. Yes.
Right. And it's doesn't feel right in our bones.
Yes. Yes.
I'm happy for a cookie if that's the case.
Sure. Who's the best?
But it's also just team?
Yeah.
As a fan.
Yeah.
You know, I remember when Chris Bryant tried to file a grievance because everybody knew it was going to be April 10th that he was going to arrive. It was 11 days. It's all he needed, and then there he was.
Right.
And come on, like we can't keep doing
this. Needed to work on his defense, right?
Yeah. Oh gosh. Oh man, you know, his tools are just not quite where we want them.
Yes, right.
Unbelievable. Right. But I mean, we see all the time with like prospect pitchers that, I mean, I've said many a time that the best pitcher on said team is the guy who's in AAA. You know, the second he arrives, we know he's going to be a better player. It still just doesn't seem right in that way. Finding the right solution, though, there's so many complexities with it. I mean, a lot of people in the comments right now make a really good point saying you have the union who won't like the fact that they probably will get reduced contracts because they're making fewer starts and you can prove it less, you know, which is a good point. If players getting released more, they don't want that, right? That's not good too. So how do we find a good balance? The answer is that owners are billionaires and they should spend more money. There you go.
Well, we agree on that. That's for sure. You know, I always thought, you know, Nick, just I don't want to get into this being a sort of a collective bargaining issue kind of a show. But I will say this, that from a player standpoint and my own, you know, as the American League rep for years and in the middle of the strike in 95, what I will say is this is for a player, for the players, it should be rights oriented. it's hard to get into economic issues when you're a ball. I'm a pitcher. I can't really debate economics with you. The value of a salary cap or not, or, you know, cost of labor. But what I can tell you is that freedom issues are real. And the minor leaguers now have a union, which is a great step forward.
It's so good.
And that can the major league players be free sooner? You know, we used to have this debate, and, you know, this is pie in the sky, right? What if we could trade the arbitration years for free agency? What if you're a free agent after 3 years? You know, and of course the owners wouldn't want that. But what would be the residual effect of that? No more arbitration, or make arbitration after 2 years. You get one year of arbitration, and after 3 years, you're a free agent. Teams would have to compete. Scouts would have to compete. You'd have to identify talent sooner, pay them sooner. There'd be more of an evenly distributed, at least theoretically, a more evenly distributed, you know, compensation system in place. Younger players would get paid more sooner. Veteran players wouldn't get pushed out as much at the end of their career because younger players were so cheap for the first 6 years of their career. Six years is a long time.
Yeah.
To have your contract controlled in the
major leagues. You can have your peak of 5 years and then you're a free agent and then it's not. Yeah. You know?
Average career is what, three years? It's been around that forever. So I don't know. That's just food for thought. That's my thought of the day. File that one away for when we have a lockout in another year or two.
Oh, don't do that to me, David. Oh my gosh. What we'll do is we'll have you, you know, you'll call some games with us during that lockout. That's what we'll do. We'll get through it together.
Wishful thinking on my part, but we always thought that. You know what? Couldn't we be free agents sooner? You know, you get the draft. You got minor leagues you can control for 6 years. Major leagues you can control for 6 years. Theoretically, you have 13 years of contractual control before you're a true free agent. You know, I mean that's a marginal type situation with a player that was in the minor league 6 years too. You know, generally that doesn't happen, but. Nonetheless, it's a lot of contractual control, a lot of surplus value. It skews the whole system. Who gets paid? Who doesn't get paid? Does Will Warren make the team? Or do we send him down to keep Cookie Carrasco as the fifth starter so we can keep our depth or, manipulate the service time? You know, those sorts of issues.
Right. No, absolutely. So I want to wrap this up with just one more question. And I'm going to let you kind of expand a little bit because you often talk a lot about the Yankees for obvious reasons. And I want you to express your love for a pitcher who's not associated with the Yankees in any way, has never been, that you are just so excited to watch this year that isn't Paul Skeens.
So many great young arms coming up, so many other arms that you want to see develop. I'm just a huge fan of Sandy Alcantara. I don't want to butcher Alcantara. I guess I butcher his last name so much. But one thing, you know, is to me is that, boy, when you watch him pitch in the World Baseball Classic before he blew out in March that year, when he was blowing in the upper 90s, pitching his heart out. Boy, that guy's a warrior. You know, he just is. And he didn't care. He didn't care about his career. He was pitching for his country in the World Baseball Classic. So in an exhibition. So, he's the guy. I think he's going to be front and center. He's throwing the ball great in the spring so far. Early results are great. Another guy that was a top prospect at one point has been through the ringer. And can he pitch? Can he not? Casey Mize is throwing the ball pretty well in Detroit this spring so far.
Yeah.
I always liked Casey. You know, I thought, and I know that he needed to refine his repertoire a little bit and learn the game, learn his craft, and he got hurt. But he's a little bit of a sleeper. If you're looking for a sleeper, watch out for Casey Mize. But, of course, it's Sandy in Miami. Who everybody's watching him. Everybody wants him. Come up to the trade deadline, he's going to be story number one.
Oh, absolutely. It's actually funny. You just picked Sandy is – I literally have a shirt that says Sandy Crush. And Sandy's just one of my favorites. And then you chose Eno's favorite, Casey Mize. So
wow, I didn't know that.
Good picks there. Casey, what I love about him is that he's such a good mind too.
And yes.
He told Eno, I don't have a feel for spin. And like hearing a pitcher be like, oh, cool. Great. Okay, let's talk about this. You know, that's our language. And that's the real thing for me with Mize is he has that 7 feet of extension, which is kind of that threshold you want to hit that says, hey, cool, now I'm really getting surprisingly close to them. Good velocity, 95, 96. more vert than he did before, good location on that four seamer upstairs. It's just what is going to set that up. Right. Is it the old splitter? Is he going to be consistent with it? Right. I hope so.
I saw a couple of decent looking sliders in there, but we'll see. We'll see.
Well, that's the thing. Is the slider going to be good enough? Yeah. Right. And actually, when he first came up, he had this kind of cutter. I call it the golden pitch. In his debut, it was so good. It was just like anytime I just throw this cutter and I get my outs. I don't know if you know this about me, but I have a war with splitters. And I want to explain a little bit further because I used to throw one. I had the most ridiculous, it was really a fork ball, but like I had a seam all the way through the middle. I would do this thing and I would tighten it up if I wanted it to be less fork. And then if I want it to be more of that big loop, right? You have the webbing open and then you push it down to get it a little bit tighter, like all the way
Tom Hinkie style. Tom Hinkie threw his like that.
Is that right? I've been trying to find another pitcher that throws it like this.
Kind of like that. Tom Hinkie. He was a Blue Jays reliever. Had a nice run there. Heck of a forkball. Really good one. Yeah.
Oh, it's so fun. Yeah. You stay straight on top of it, right? Yes. If you're listening, you have the seam all the way exposed through the middle, and I'm actually using my index and my middle finger to actually grip the opposite seams on 180 on other sides of the ball. Yes. But it's volatile. There were days that I had it and days I didn't. I mean, obviously, you know about this.
Sure.
And would you say that if this is your only number two pitch, that's not a reliable number two pitch, right?
No, it can't. No, it cannot be, because you've got to have the command that your number two pitch, you have to be able to throw for a strike.
Yeah.
You have to be able to show the hitter that you can throw for a strike, and then also have just one that you can get a swing and miss with. So that's the 1-2 punch with your best secondary pitch, is one you can get over and one you can just miss with. That's what makes it your number two pitch off of your fastball. So if you don't have that kind of command with it, then it's going to be troublesome, because major league hitters will sit on your fastball. And if you can't throw your secondary pitch, whatever that is, for a strike, they're just going to spit on it. Or they're going to, anytime they recognize any spin at all that's different than your fastball, they're just not going to swing.
And the thing I like Tanaka is that he had a great one, but he also had the slider, and the slider was the glue because he was able to get strikes with that.
Yes, both sides of the plate too, yes.
Right. And with Gausman, it's interesting because Gausman had the most consistent splitter in baseball for like 3 years, and now it's kind of not as there, and you're seeing some cracks in that armor. Yeah. It's rare to see someone really be able to go 1-2 with splitter, which Baez is kind of suggesting. So really, to me, it's just please get that slider just good enough, and then you could really absolutely explode.
Yeah, if his velocity's back, that'll help his slider. Throwing 97 miles an hour helps anybody's slider.
Yeah.
You got to gear up just a little quicker to start it to catch up to that fastball. So if he can, you know, I'm a big fan of spin mirroring.
Yes.
I know some hitters say, no, I don't believe in that. I don't really see that kind of spin. But you know what? First time I learned about spin mirroring was with a changeup pitcher named Charlie Liebrandt, who has a son who's actually in camp with the Yankees this year in the bullpen. Charlie Liebrandt threw the ball 85 miles an hour, four seamers that he painted in and out, and then threw a four-seam changeup. First guy I ever saw throw a circle four-seam changeup.
Oh, really?
He had that spin mirroring. This was circa 1985.
Yeah.
And Charlie Liebrandt had a four-seam circle change. Now, I'm not sure how Mario Soto threw his. I think his was probably more of a two-seam-oriented circle change grip.
Sure.
But that spin mirroring effect, Charlie Liebrandt was really an effective pitcher for somebody who had below-average stuff. And it was based on spin mirroring. The spin of his changeup looked exactly like his four-seam fastball, and he got a lot of swings and misses at high changeups. And people, he'd have hitters walk back to the dugout shaking their head like, you got away with that mistake. And actually, no, he's throwing it on the same plane in the same tunnel in the same window as his four-seam fastball. He's just, you know, he's one of the first ones I ever saw that I was like, wow, that works. That spin mirroring thing can work.
It's not a mistake if you got a whiff. But what David's talking about here for everybody watching is essentially you take your four-seamer grip and you just replace your index and your middle finger with your middle and your ring finger.
Yes.
And that's how you make the circle change. So you're essentially throwing a four-seamer. It's just not with your index finger. And what that does is it makes your hand kind of go over the ball more. That means it comes out a little slower and it feels more of the fingers. And the more that the ball touches your fingers, it's going to be slower. And I hated this because I couldn't throw my ring finger. I always had to throw my index finger.
Right.
And it just felt so weird. And I was like, no, I'll do the Foch ball. I'll do the light splitter instead. Yeah. I don't care. What is interesting is you're telling me that everybody threw like a two seam grip. So essentially you have your middle and your ring there.
Maddox, Glavin, all were two seam oriented circle changes.
Oh man, that's so cool. So actually what's funny is I remember even talking to Tyone about it, cause he would throw sinkers all the time with Pittsburgh, but then he would throw his changeup. And I was like, you're throwing a four seam grip because that does not have the horizontal ride of it. I'm like, why are you doing that? You should mirror this. And I eventually just abandoned the changeup. No. and last one there is Johan Santana to me is the first one I come with. I mean, he was obsessed. Everything possible to make his changeup look like his four seamer.
Yes.
And anytime that you have a different one, I agree with you completely. Christopher Sanchez is a good example, as I see from the chat. Like he does that with his sinker and his changeup. Logan Webb does that. That's why he throws as many sinkers as he does. The changeup looks just like that.
Yes.
And it's all two seam grip and everything is mirrored. Great calls with Sandy and Casey Mize. And David, I can't thank you enough for coming on here. This has been such a joy. I believe you're going back to broadcasting soon. Is that right? Inside of spring training? Should we see you there soon?
Yes. Yeah. I'll do a couple of Yankee games in the third week of March here. And then, opening night, we're out in LA. Detroit Dodgers. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Well, have a fantastic time with that. Thank you so much for joining me today on The Craft. My name is Nick Pollock, and we'll talk about The Craft of Pitching again next week. Thank you, everyone.